This is Rabbi Shai Held, Parashat Ki Teitze 5775, Combating Cruelty, Amalek Within and Without. Appalled by its savage offensive against Israel, the Torah considers Amalek a perpetual enemy of both God and Israel. While Amalek's behavior is undoubtedly abhorrent, there is something worrying about both the depth and the duration of hatred prescribed. If Amalek is detestable, why must its children be denounced as enemies of God? And by mandating Israel to kill every last Amalekite, does not the Torah run the risk of inculcating in Israel the very cruelty it so detests? To read the Torah's troubling charge to wipe out Amalek is, of necessity, to struggle with it. Inching closer to Mount Sinai after their miraculous liberation from Egypt, the Israelites are attacked by Amalek, a nomadic people from the south of Canaan, and a heated battle ensues. While Moses holds up God's staff, Joshua and his troops defeat the enemy. But Amalek's aggression leaves an indelible scar. God instructs Moses, quote, "Inscribe this in a document as a reminder, and read it aloud to Joshua. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." Moses builds an altar and names it Hashem Nisi, "The Lord is my banner." Quote, "It means, hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages." Walter Brueggemann explains that the altar and the banner are to make it clear for all time that hostility toward Amalek is deep, for perpetuity, and authorized by God. The logic of these verses is difficult to discern. Other nations treat Israel cruelly, but do not thereby become objects of enduring enmity. Edom, for example, callously refuses Israel passage through its land, yet Israel is taught, "You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother." Egypt enslaves and oppresses Israel for generations, yet the Torah commands, "You shall not abhor an Egyptian, for you were a stranger in his land." Why is Amalek different? What is it about Amalek's attack that so incurs the wrath of God? Exodus offers no obvious answers. According to one scholar, we have no evidence of more than conventional conflict, and nothing is noticeably barbaric in the relationship between the two peoples. But Bible scholar Stephen Chapman finds Exodus' silence about the impetus for Amalek's attack highly suggestive. On his account, quote, "The Amalekite attack may have been perceived as particularly egregious precisely because there was no cause for it." Yet the text may hint at another explanation. Moses tells Joshua that before the battle, he will station himself on top of the hill with the staff, Mateh, of God in his hand. Victory, as we've seen, is tied to Moses' raising his hand, Yado. The centrality of Moses' hand and staff in the story calls to mind Israel's recent departure from Egypt. When the sea is about to be split so that the Israelites may cross, God instructs Moses, "You lift up your rod, Mateh, and hold out your hand, Yadcha, over the sea and split it." In light of the parallel, Terence Fredheim suggests that what we have in our story is pharaonic conflict revisited. Pharaoh may be dead, but Israel is not thereby forever free from such chaotic powers embodied in historical enemies. In its savage strike against Israel, Amalek makes clear that the brutality of Egypt lives on. Amalek is thus Pharaoh redivivus. But if Amalek is hated because it is akin to Egypt, why is Egypt itself not reviled in the same way? Perhaps the answer lies in the timing of Amalek's attack. Israel has just been liberated from Egypt. In the wake of that stunning event, the nations of the world have heard of God's salvation and are trembling in fear. The Israelites are on their way to Sinai and from there to the Promised Land. Amalek strikes precisely at the moment that God's promises are about to be fulfilled. Cornelius Hauptmann observes that Amalek's attack is essentially an attempt to cut short the exodus out of Egypt and to frustrate the fulfillment of the promises. For this reason, according to Hauptmann, Amalek becomes not just any enemy, but the enemy. Deuteronomy offers another explanation and justification of Amalek's ignominious status. Parashat Ki Teitze concludes with a fiery mandate, quote, "Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt, how, undeterred by fear of God, he fell upon you on the march when you were famished and weary, and cut down all the stragglers in your rear." Israel is charged to act on this horrific memory. Quote, "Therefore, when the Lord your God grants you safety from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a hereditary portion, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget." Note the important shift. Where in Exodus God had pledged to wipe out Amalek, in Deuteronomy God assigns the task to Israel. In cutting down the stragglers in the rear, Amalek commits what to Deuteronomy is the ultimate crime. They are merciless to the weak. To attack a long degraded people just as it is given its first taste of freedom would be bad enough. But Amalek goes much further. It specifically directs its assault against those who lag behind, the elderly, the very young, the ailing, etc., and thus betrays a lack of even the most elementary decency. To set upon the weak in this way is a sign of extreme human callousness, which in turn is evidence of no fear of God. Amalek thus represents everything Deuteronomy hopes Israel itself will not be. Where Amalek is barbarous and cruel, Israel is to build a society in which the weak and defenseless are protected and cared for. Israel disdains Amalek, but at least as important, it disdains what Amalek stands for. In the Jewish imagination, Amalek comes to be seen as the archetype of murderous evil, the personification of eternal inhumanity and lack of scruples. Thus, for example, the genocidal Haman is said to be descended from Agag, an Amalekite king. For rabbinic tradition, Amalek represents a kind of cosmic evil. A Talmudic sage teaches that, quote, "As long as the descendants of Amalek are in the world, neither the name of God nor the throne of God is whole. When the descendants of Amalek have disappeared, the name is whole and the throne is whole." There is something profoundly disturbing about all this. It is one thing to abhor Amalek's inhumanity. It is quite another to condemn all Amalekites, present and future, as eternal enemies of God. Two competing impulses play themselves out in rabbinic texts. On the one hand, as we've seen, there is the insistence that Amalek is a monster and must therefore remain a pariah for all eternity. This is intended to have concrete this-worldly ramifications. As the Talmudic sage Rabbi Eliezer teaches, quote, "If anyone from any of the nations of the world comes to convert to Judaism, they must accept him, but from the house of Amalek, they must not accept him." Yet on the other hand, a softer rabbinic voice declares that the descendants of Haman studied Torah among the rabbis in Bnei Brak. As Abisagi explains, according to this source, descendants of Amalek were not only accepted as converts, but also belonged to the cultural elite of the Jewish people and were counted among its most distinguished teachers. Unease with the idea that God would command Israel to hate one particular nation for all time leads some traditional thinkers to interpret the mandate to blot out Amalek symbolically. Rabbi Moshe Avigdor Amiel, for example, sees an eternal struggle between the culture of the book on the one hand and the culture of the sword on the other. Whereas Israel represents the former, Amalek stands for the latter. The triumph of the book over the sword is Judaism's ultimate ideal. Since the sword cannot ultimately be abolished by the sword, quote, "evil cannot be extirpated by evil means," unquote, what Israel aspires to is a cultural victory, when the brutality and barbarism embodied by the sword will finally be defeated. There is another mode of interpretation which is at once symbolic and concrete. During the Shoah, many Jewish thinkers equated anti-Semitism with Amalek. One can easily imagine a Jewish thinker extending the image in a more generalized way, to people who behave in monstrous ways, brazenly and remorselessly attacking the innocent. Think, for example, of ISIS. This is eminently understandable. Amalek is the rhetorical device in Judaism's arsenal for speaking of utter ruthlessness and inhumanity. And yet, such moves are also extremely dangerous. In labeling someone an Amalekite, and thus raising them to the level of metaphysical evil, we run the risk of giving ourselves license to behave in savage ways in attempting to root out savagery. In the process, we may become the very thing we set out to combat. If we wish to employ the language of evil, we must be vigilant lest it pave the way for us to behave in evil ways. The Hasidic master Leib Yitzchak of Berdichev teaches, quote, "It seems that not only are the children of Israel commanded to blot out Amalek, but also every individual Jew must blot out that evil part called Amalek, which is hidden in his heart. As long as the seed of Amalek is in the world, since a person is a miniature world, a microcosm, Amalek exists in the evil potential within that person, which awakens anew, again and again, to cause him to sin." Although Levi Yitzchak no doubt intends to offer a psychological spiritual interpretation of the mandate to blot out Amalek, his comments have important implications for the moral political realm as well. We should not invoke the language of Amalek and of evil more generally, unless and until we are willing to recognize the evil potential within ourselves as well. Shabbat Shalom.